Hello and welcome to the Iota Unum podcasts from the Latin Mass Society. In the company of some great friends of tradition from around the world, we will be drilling into some of the fundamental issues affecting us today in the church and the world.
The importance of the family is that it is in the family that the faith is typically passed on to the next generation. The faith can be passed on to children in an orphanage, or to adult converts, but that isn't how it usually happens over the centuries, across the world. Catholic parents obviously have an obligation to pass the faith on to their own children, and the sacrament of matrimony gives them graces to help them do this. As the old catechisms say, to bring up their children in the fear of the Lord. This is all very obvious, I hope, but I want to draw some implications from it which are, I think, less obvious. And which will help me to explore what I call somewhat overdramatically the two enemies of the domestic church. So the two enemies I've identified today are the ideology of the mainstream educational establishment and the decline of culture. So let's talk about the educational establishment. I speak, of course, as an educator. I was for 18 years a member of the philosophy faculty at Oxford University, so I'm not entirely outside this phenomenon, about which I'm going to be quite rude. I don't dislike all teachers, just the bad ones. So the family is an institution of natural law, and across different cultures we can see the essential elements of the family and its essential functions. Procreation, protection, nurture, and education of children. When marriage is raised to the dignity of a sacrament, sacramental graces are given to the couple to carry out this duty. Catholics are increasingly having to remind educationalists that when we entrust our children to schools, we are delegating our authority to them. We are increasingly faced by a professional mindset that schools and even individual teachers have the right and duty to form our children according to their ideas, which are often very strange indeed. I'm not going to explore these ideas, you'll be glad to hear. Sexual libertinism, wokeism, whatever the latest thing might be. But I want to say something about how we can help our children survive them. I'm afraid this is going to be in terms of theory rather than detailed practical advice, because of the different circumstances different families face. I personally addressed this problem for my children by home educating them up to the age of about 16. But this is simply impossible for parents in some countries, and I know that in the United States rules about homeschooling vary from state to state. In addition to the legal regime, every family has different circumstances connected with the parents' jobs and the children's educational needs. In other words, I don't want to lay down the law for anyone. I don't want to be dogmatic about it, but also not to try to make we should not make things easier for ourselves by closing our eyes to the problems. To illustrate, I have many times heard friends and acquaintances who are not traditional Catholics say, our children go to this great school, we're very happy with it. And I say, that's wonderful. So how do they handle sex education in this school? And they say, I have no idea. And I say, well, just ask them what materials they use and see what they say. And they say, no, I'm not going to do that. And that's the end of the conversation. During the COVID lockdowns, there were various newspaper articles and remarks on social media about people who had the reality shoved under their noses. When school sent exercises and images to pupils by email and asked parents to print them off, or parents who saw the screen during remote lessons, and the parents sometimes say, yes, I was really shocked, and we protested. And the school said it was all a mistake, so I'm sure it's fine. Now, I don't want to judge anyone, and God alone can read hearts. I know some parents were indeed radicalized by these experiences and did take concrete measures, but many did not. And speaking personally, I don't want to find myself on the wrong side of this kind of conversation at the last judgment. So those are the people who close their eyes. But there are also Catholics and other Christian parents who do recognise the problem, but adopt a strategy which I also think is a mistake. I say it's a mistake if it's a deliberate strategy and not just where we can't do anything better. This is the idea that we should send our children into school to do battle with the bad things they will find there, as if we were sending off a knight errant to do battle with a dragon. Now, if you have no alternative but to send your child to a horrible school, this might be for all kinds of reasons. This talk might be heard by a single mother in the prison system. Let's not make any judgments in advance. Then, of course, the best you can do is prepare your child to resist anything untrue in advance and then talk to them afterwards. What I would like to criticise is something a bit different. It is making a virtue of this. You hear these little stories on social media. My six-year-old was told such and such in his class, and he had this great comeback. Isn't that wonderful? Well, perhaps it is wonderful. But it's not the job of our six-year-olds to engage in arguments with which we ourselves do not want to engage. I appreciate the fact that woke primary school teachers can be deeply stupid. But in arguing about the hot-button issues of the day, they have huge advantages over our six-year-olds. Even if the six-year-olds consistently got the better of the argument, they will, in the meantime, be receiving an absolutely terrible education. What sort of education can you receive from teachers you neither trust nor respect? This principle isn't just something which applies at the age of six, naturally. It's a wider point. My own view is that the opportunities teachers have to influence our children, not through reasoned argument, but by emotional manipulation, exposure to selected information, and mere appeal to authority, do at least taper off a bit as they get older and they acquire intellectual maturity. So I'm less concerned about university teachers and at sixth form, what we call sixth form, the final 2 years of school, though, of course, education at the older end of the spectrum holds other problems which may derive more from the other students rather than the teachers. The way I would respond to these challenges is most easily discussed in the context of the second enemy of the domestic church, which is the decline of culture. So, after having published my book, that's the one of the books there, with the ruined abbey on the front. After having published that book last year about the family and the liturgy, I've been thinking a lot about the family and culture. In February, I visited Ireland. I gave three talks on different aspects of this question, which you can hear on the Latin Mass Society podcast channel. You just search Latin Mass Society and it pops up. If the soporific effects of this talk aren't enough for you, you can double the dose in your own time. So today, I'm going to try and take a different path through closely related issues. The connection between the family and culture is that the family is the context for most cultural production, and the most authentic cultural production. You may think it's surprising because artists are the paradigm creators of cultural artefacts, and they mostly don't do it in a family setting. However, without belittling high art of all genres, this is only a small part of culture, and the rest is created in a very different way. Language, clothing, food are hugely important elements of culture. If you add home decoration, storytelling, music making, dancing that have taken place in the family home all over the world over the centuries, you must have at least 95% of culture. Admittedly, these are somewhat subjective measurements. But in any case, the other 5%, the culture of the court, the theatre, the university, the professional artist studio, and so on. Yes, it's very important. It has a powerful influence on the rest. But it does not represent anything like the whole culture of a cultural group. Furthermore, as T.S. Eliot argued in his book, notes towards a definition of culture. High culture is dependent on low culture, not the other way around. High culture is dependent on low culture. What he meant was poetry, as an example he's interested in, depends on the use of words and the rhythms of speech found among ordinary people. In pointing this out, I'm consciously disagreeing with the view that the family home lost its importance when economic activity moved out of it in the Industrial Revolution. So, when spinning and weaving and handicrafts were swallowed up by huge firms and small-scale farming disappeared into large-scale mechanised farming. And those who had to look after children had to leave the labour force, and those who were in the labour force had to leave the home. This was a very significant development, no doubt about it, but the idea that the home was thereafter entirely bereft of importance implies that only things of measurable economic value have importance, which I'm sure only has to be stated to be rejected. So what people at the time of this transition tended to say was that the home, the new home, the home without the loom and everything, was instead a sacred environment, the abode of women and children, sheltered from the depravity of the world of work. Now, this is easy to mock, and I've done a bit of mocking of myself in one of those books, but I think there is something in this general area which is true and important, and the same thing can be said about the trad wife phenomenon, which in some ways picks up where the 19th century conception of the home left off. For all the sentimentality and clickbaity nonsense, it is true and it is important that the home is a cultural environment where culture comes together, a place where one is at home, where one is comfortable, nourished in every sense, and safe. A great deal could be said about this, and a great deal, in fact, should be said about what is correct and what is mistaken in the 19th century conception of the home and by the conception presented by the tradwife TikTok influencers. And I confess I haven't watched them nearly enough to comment on them in detail. I've just been amazed, absolutely amazed, well, a few I have seen. But this isn't the place for a detailed discussion. If we can all agree that the home is the place where overwhelmingly culture happens, and I want to explore the implications of that. The first thing to notice is that in modern Western society, the typical home is radically culturally impoverished. And the slack is not being taken up outside the home. It is important to remember that Hebrew evening classes for Jewish children, travelling dancing masters in 19th century Scotland, and long hours spent by Catholic priests teaching catechism to children are not things that happen in response to a dwindling domestic commitment to culture. They are things which happen when domestic culture is rich and vigorous, and families are so invested in it that they will commit time, effort, and money to bringing their children to an even higher level of culture than can be done by the efforts of the parents alone. Who is going to get those little Jewish children to do their homework? Who is going to get the little Johnny to practice his violin, etc.? So, the first thing to... on the one hand, the home is the place where the culture is, where the faith is manifested and passed on. And on the other hand, the home is the place where the culture is practiced and passed on. This is obviously not a coincidence. The Catholic religion is composed not merely of creedal propositions, but of cultural practices. It can be passed on just as other cultural artifacts are passed on in the family, where young children can witness it, join in with it, and ask questions about it. So there is no sharp distinction, I would say, between creedal formulas and cultural practices. Reciting the Apostles' Creed as part of family prayers is a cultural practice, as is singing the Nicene Creed in Mass on Sundays. Someone in Gironella's novel, The Cypresses Believe in God, about Spain in the Civil War, before the Civil War, recites the creed as a way of timing boiled eggs. Doing catechism with daddy before bed is a cultural practice, and a great deal more is passed on in exploring the formulas of faith to a child than just the formulas of faith. I stress this because we often hear a contrast being made between real Catholics and merely cultural Catholics. We all know what is being referred to here. Someone can maintain a cultural practices associated with a faith and not have the faith. I won't mention the obvious people of whom this could be said. And in the ruins of once vigorous Catholic communities, we can see this all the time, as we do in the context of other religions. There are merely cultural Jews, Muslims, and so on. The fact that the family has a Christmas tree tells you nothing about the depth of their faith. The fact they attend Mass at Christmas and Easter doesn't tell you very much. What I would suggest, though, is that what we mean when we talk about merely cultural Catholics, or indeed a merely cultural Muslim or Jew, or whatever, is someone who not only lacks the faith, but also usually has a very shallow cultural formation as well. It is not just that their cultural practices are insincere, it is that the culture itself has grown extremely thin. Supposing someone, we were to talk about a merely cultural Catholic, and someone brought us the information, well, don't you know, this person goes to Mass every Sunday. He goes on long walking pilgrimages to shrines. He fasts on Fridays and throughout Lent. We would sit there thinking, well, these are cultural practices, but someone who didn't have the faith would not be doing those things. So perhaps it's not a merely cultural Catholic after all, because those things are expressions of belief. The reason I'm emphasising this is that the modern West, there is a tendency to make a sharp distinction between outward behaviour and sincere inner conviction. So we're very beholden to the idea that you can have this within yourself and it not find any expression at all. So I'm influenced on this point by Martin Moserbach's wonderful book, The Heresy of Formlessness. But that's something you can look into afterwards. It is certainly possible to be insincere. There's no denying insincerity is out there. But what is strange about modern Western thinking is that it goes beyond criticism of hypocrisy to rejection of the role of outward behaviour and habit in the moral life. And I blame Martin Luther. So Martin Luther thought that the key to salvation was a moment of conversion. He thought this was a moment of irresistible divine grace, but it also looks rather like an act of will. So Luther can take the credit not only for evangelical Protestant notions about conversion experiences, with which we're very familiar, but also existentialism, which I'll explain slightly. This is the view that life should be seen as a series of character-defining moment decisions, each one of which is radically free. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who came from a Lutheran background, furthermore argued that doing a good action out of habit robs it of what he called moral worth. Now, the influence of this way of thinking is so powerful today that one can devalue any good action by saying that, oh, he just did it through habit. A very different view is that of Aristotle, who pointed out that we reveal our character when we do things in accordance with character. We are born with a certain nature, and education and habituation can modify this in such a way that certain kinds of action, as we still say, are second nature. If someone does something strikingly out of character, we should be more inclined to write this off as a one-off if it is good, and to pity and pardon the agent if it is bad. Despite the influence of Luther, who loathed Aristotle, we still hear people convicted of crimes saying that their action should be punished less severely because it was out of character. That's not the real me, they would say. Their character is their real selves, and what flows from character, that is to say their habits, is more authentically them than what comes out in a spontaneous moment of madness. In this way, the debate between Aristotle and Luther continues in modern discourse. But a lot of modern discussions of religious affiliation are tilted towards the Lutheran view. On the other hand, the Catholic Church adopted Aristotle with enthusiasm in the 13th century because he fitted in so well with a Catholic understanding of the spiritual life. The Church did not accept Aristotle uncritically. Aristotle did not know, could not know, that some virtues are infused into the soul by God. The theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, and things like the supernatural courage of the martyrs. A number of very young women were venerated as martyrs with great solemnity in the Roman Church, and of course they still are. Felicitas, Perpetua, Agatha, Lucy, Agnes, Cecilia, and Anastasia are mentioned in the canon, and you can see the tiny skull of St. Agnes in her church in the Piazza Navona. If you're in Rome, don't miss your chance to do that if you could find the church open. She must have been extremely young. This skull is hardly bigger than my fist. So, they illustrate St. Paul's phrase that God's power is made perfect in weakness from 2 Corinthians because their indomitable fortitude was not something they gained by training, but by grace. But their natural virtues are no less, the natural virtues are no less essential to the spiritual life because if our souls are overgrown with vices, we are not open to the operation of infused virtues. So we have to set to work to weaken our vices and strengthen our natural virtues in exactly the way Aristotle described, by not doing the actions the vices prompt us to do and by forcing ourselves to the action virtues would prompt us to do if we had them. In this way, we rid ourselves of vices and virtuous action becomes habitual. I used to teach Aristotle so I could talk all day about his, but I'm going to try and restrain myself and limit myself to saying a little more about what virtue is. A virtue is a disposition to act in a certain way or according to a certain principle. It doesn't follow that the principle can be codified, that is, set out in words, to make it fully understood by someone who didn't have the virtue. Grasping what a virtue demands in different situations is something one learns at the same time as one acquires the habit of the virtuous action. So a virtue is, first, a tendency to act in a certain way. And secondly, a kind of knowledge or understanding about what is called for by the virtue. It is also, thirdly, a state of the soul that makes acting in this way easy, or at least easier, and even pleasurable, and it makes acting against it less attractive. The virtuous man finds the idea of action contrary to virtue repelling. One can learn virtue best from the example of others who have the virtue, but examples in stories will also help one grasp what it is all about. Teaching and learning virtues is not primarily an intellectual exercise, nor is it something that has to be given a special slot in the timetable. It happens naturally in the right environment, and one can at least start the building up of a good habit by forcing someone to act in a certain way. This might sound surprising, but this is how we teach children table manners. If you don't persuade a three-year-old to use a knife and fork, you repeatedly encourage them to do it because everyone else does and because you say so. It might help if you think about the parallel between a virtue and a skill, like embroidery or wood carving or hunting. However, I'm not going to elaborate on the parallel here. You may be thinking this: all the natural virtues will be for nothing if you fall into mortal sin just once. And a life of virtue is of no consequence. Sorry, a life of vice is of no consequence if you have a conversion experience and make an act of perfect contrition. This is true, but to say that on its own is extremely misleading. It would be an understatement to say that we are less likely to fall into mortal sin and fail to repent if we have built up powerful virtues over the course of our lives. Equally, the chance of repentance is reduced by the growth of vice in our hearts over a long period of time. neither virtue nor vice cancels free will. That is true. But we need to get away from an existentialist notion of free will as a capacity for random choices, totally unconditioned by our lives up to the moment of choice. Some of the options we have that other people might find attractive are closed off to us because they are incomprehensible to us or strike us as deeply shameful. Others are overwhelmingly attractive because they give us everything we truly want, and it just makes no sense for us to refuse them. Our job is to make these psychological reactions line up with the corresponding moral options for ourselves and for our children. And this is the work of a lifetime. So someone might say at this point, it is easy to see how one can establish habitual actions through the culture of the home, but what about beliefs? Surely in order to believe something, one has to learn the creedal formula and be convinced of it somehow. Well, I am an intellectual by training and by disposition, so I'm not against setting out the faith in words and providing arguments for it. I love that stuff and I could do it all day long. But, as I have already indicated, the distinction between culture and belief is not as wide as this contrast suggests. When you teach your children basic mathematics, you don't try to prove the truth of mathematical principles. When you set out to teach history, you don't try to prove that Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 or whatever. You start all subjects with a set of ideas, facts, and principles that form the young mind and build up into a way of understanding the world. Apologetics in theology, like the philosophy of mathematics, or the sources of history, is something for a much later stage in education. The picture of the world that our Catholic faith establishes in our children's minds is built up by what they learnt in catechism, and that is important. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. But your children will have been living in your home for more than 5 years by the time you get a catechism out and start going through it with them. And the foundations for catechesis will already have been laid by your home life. Your family prayers, the figure on the crucifix, what happens in church, the nativity scene, the experience of Christmas, siblings receiving the sacraments, cousins getting married, and grandparents dying. It is impossible to explain these things fully to children, age 1, 2, 3, or 4. We can say a little, sometimes to help them, but experiences like these are how children learn about every aspect of the world, not just the faith. They experience things they don't understand, but they gradually piece it together and understand more and more. And of course, adults do the same thing. This process doesn't stop when you're 18. Small children don't need long explanations and wouldn't understand them anyway, but they can distinguish a joyful occasion from a sad one, and they can take care. They can see the care taken over a First Communion dress, the honour given to the images of the saints, and the intricacy of liturgical music. When you do get out the catechism, you find that you have a large number of shared experiences you can use to help explain the points of the catechism. I'm not trained to teach my grandmother suck eggs here. This is obvious, and I'm sure you've all experienced it. My point, though, is that this is more controversial than it sounds. There is a tendency in the church today to say that what young Catholics need is catechism, 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 and to regard Catholic culture as a decorative but non-functional thing that sits on top of that. It is true that most young Catholics are very poorly catechized, present company excepted, I'm sure. But, and more catechism would seem to be called for in response to that melancholy fact, but not so fast. Formation in Catholic culture comes first. And this formation should continue alongside catechism. I'm not saying that it's impossible to teach catechism to people without Catholic culture, but it's much harder and it's much less likely to stick unless, like adult converts, they are intellectually and emotionally committed to learning it. There are lots of reasons why the importance of Catholic culture is downplayed in the church today. In a past talk, I explored the problem of rationalism, which says that only things which can be set out as verbal propositions count for anything, and the allure of what people call intentional communities. We can talk about that later if you like. But I want to explore another reason here. You know, this is the fact that Catholic culture varies over time and between different places in a way that Catholic doctrine does not. We all believe the Nicene Creed, and I hope we can all take the anti-modernist oath, but obviously Spanish, Bavarian, Maronite, and Irish Catholic culture are not identical with each other. In America and in England, certainly in England, I expect this applies to you as well, this presents us with a practical difficulty, inasmuch as our communities are comprised of people from specific forms of Catholic culture alongside people with a rather weak Catholic culture. I'm a cradle Catholic, but both of my parents were converts, so I can't summon up a great deal of authentic English Catholic culture for my children, not at least not without going a long way back into the past. We just have to make do with German Christmas trees, Italian crib scenes, Polish painted eggs, reproduction of medieval sacred architecture, and stories of the English martyrs from the 16th century. But, you know, that's not so bad, is it? The Catholic Church has successfully incorporated many different cultures without destroying these cultures. And this is a very beautiful thing. I think, though, that that very fact that Catholic culture varies makes some people think that it's not important. The argument goes like this. It can't be important for Bavarian Catholics to build beautiful outside altars for Corpus Christi processions, for example, because, let's say, Japanese Catholics or whatever don't, and they're perfectly fine. Similarly, in the debate about the liturgy, you hear people saying, in some places in past centuries, Catholics received Holy Communion kneeling and on the tongue, but at other times, in other places, they received standing or in the hand. If you look into it, it turns out that the ones who received standing used to prostrate themselves and kiss the priest's foot or do some other elaborate ritual before and after receiving in the hand, they had a ritual washing of the hands. Are we supposed to draw the conclusion that because they have been different ways of showing a high degree of reverence towards the Blessed Sacrament, we don't need to have any form of reverence before receiving the Blessed Sacrament? The fallacy here is like saying that because Japanese people eat rice and Americans eat potatoes, human beings clearly don't need either rice or potatoes and can survive perfectly well on fresh air. We need a set of cultural practices to incarnate the faith, something that systematically illustrates, comments on, and reinforces the faith. This is done in different ways by different forms of Catholic culture. And that shows us not that we don't need culture, it shows us that we do, because every society which has been evangelized successfully has established a Catholic culture. If we want to be a sustainable Catholic community, we too need a Catholic culture in some form or other. The ideal is a culture we share with our neighbours and fellow worshippers and that connects us with the past of the place where we live and with our ancestors, but as I just noticed, things may not be as simple as that. What we can certainly do is to pick up some of the pieces from the recent and not so recent past and forge a culture together with others in our time and location that will do the job that culture must do. In drawing this to a conclusion, let me say something more about the role of culture, which up till now I have referenced only in passing. In the book about Gregorian chant from the 1930s, a German monk called Dominic Joner tried to express the role of the church as liturgical music. So here's a little quotation. Gregorian music is not merely a music of embellishment. It does not describe the text in the manner in which a garland entwines itself about a pillar, affecting no inner connection with it. Chant can also make the text interpretive, expressive, and explanative. It often brings its gradations at the very point where a declamatory rendition of the text grows in warmth, and it emphasizes that word which marks its climax. well, probably the translation's a bit not very idiomatic, but you get the general idea. Something parallel to this could be said of all devotional art. Think of a crucifixion scene. Our eyes are drawn to this or that aspect of the painting. The suffering of the holy women, the impassivity of the soldiers, the bitterness of the bad thief, the presence, visible only to us outside the painting, of the angels, and the expression on the face of the Saviour. And this may be of suffering, compassion, or triumph. The colours, the composition, and the perspective all contribute to guide our feelings. Such art can be good, and it must be remembered, it can be bad. Authentic Catholic art can guide our feelings well. Sentimental, anti-Semitic, or heretical art can misguide them. Now, think of your home. Our growing children begin to become aware of the truths of faith, the sacraments, and the liturgy. But from the very beginning, their experience is informed by what they see and feel at home. The relationship between their parents, the presence of devotional objects, the level of importance given to Sunday services, what happens on days of fasting and abstinence, how Christmas and Easter are celebrated. Their home culture acts as a kind of commentary on the things they learn from the catechism. But to repeat, this commentary actually comes before the texts it comments upon. And it does so not propositionally, but as an atmosphere, a set of expectations, a feeling of joy at a feast, or grim determination at a penitential exercise. The importance of this culture is difficult to exaggerate. The only reason why we could be in any doubt about its influence on young Catholics is that so many of them get so little authentic culture, and in these cases we cannot point to it as a positive influence. But if they aren't getting family prayers, if Sundays are not marked out in some way, if there is no devotional art in the house, then that does not mean there are no cultural influences on them at all. It means that their home culture will be dominated by, at best, the metaphysics of Star Wars and the morality of Harry Potter. And at its worst, by the morality of violent video games and the metaphysics of pornography. I don't, however, want to leave you with that thought. But another, something that the great Catholic counter-revolutionary philosopher Joseph de Maistre liked to say. The revolution achieves its ends by violence, disorder, and injustice. De Maistre warned his readers that it could not be overcome by those means. The counter-revolution must be a reversal of the revolution. It must be the undoing of what the revolution has done. Violence must be overcome by gentleness, disorder by order, injustice by justice. This may seem quixotic in the political sphere, and perhaps it is, but we can see how this works in the home. The enemy wishes to invade our children's imaginations with violence and fill them with disorder and injustice. We can and must resist them with a cultural formation in the faith that establishes peace, order, and justice. These things can be stronger than their opposites if they are built up steadily and securely over many years as habits in our children's hearts. Nurturing this process, as well as passing on the propositions of the faith, is the duty of the Catholic parent.
This podcast was brought to you by the Latin Mass Society. We hope you enjoyed it and would appreciate your rating the podcast on the platform you are using. If you would like to find out more, do visit our website and consider joining us or giving us a donation.